When we translate the Torah from Hebrew into English, much gets lost, or worse, distorted. Sometimes, in my opinion, this can be tragic or even dangerous. Take, for example, the word God. God's name is, well, not God, not even close. As John Lennon once said, God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Lennon may or may not have been right, but it's worth noting who John Lennon was at the end of the day, an Englishman. The word God is Anglo-Saxon in its origins. When we read the Torah, even if we want to stay neutral and continually remind ourselves that his name isn't God, we will inevitably flounder. The Christian, Anglo-Saxon, English, German connotations associated with the word God are all too engraved in our minds to disentangle ourselves from them. Put another way, Lennon would never have said, insert God's actual name here, which I'm not permitted to say, is a concept by which we measure our pain. He was far, far too much of a Christian Englishman for that, even though he was, of course, an atheist. There are many other instances of translations from Biblical Hebrew into English, or into any other language for that matter, in which the original vibe of the word just doesn't survive the conversion. The word humus in the Torah often gets translated as chickpea paste, for example. That one was a joke, but an actual one would be the word for cutting off the foreskin of the penis of an 8-day-old boy. The English word circumcision sounds truly like an arcane medieval surgery. By contrast, the Hebrew phrase of brit milah, roughly translating to pact of the word, much better captures the transcendental dignity of this ritual. Another translation in the Torah which sparked my attention occurs throughout the book of Exodus, also known as Shemot. We have always been told the story that the Israelites were slaves in Egypt. However, in Hebrew, the Israelites are not called slaves, per se, because slave is, of course, an English word. In Biblical Hebrew, they are called evedim in plural, eved in singular. Does eved translate perfectly into the word slave? That is the question. Indeed, that is the main question of this entire episode. I noticed that the word for slave has the same root letters as the word for worker in Hebrew. The Hebrew word here is eved, which sounds a lot like to work, la avod, work, avodah, or just worker, oved. In English, the word slave has a relatively specific meaning and describes the absolute worst form of servitude. A slave, we know, is the property of his or her master, and the master can treat his slaves as such. Most importantly, the word slave has no etymological connection with the word worker. Not so in Hebrew. Is it possible, I wondered, that the so-called slaves of the Torah did not have it as bad as we formerly believed? Were the Hebrews really slaves, or perhaps just workers, or maybe indentured servants? In short, was the translation from eved to slave a good or bad translation? To help me answer this question and test out my theory, I invited Azan Yadin Israel on to the Shrift. Azan Yadin Israel is a professor of Jewish studies at Rutgers University. He received his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, and the Graduate Theological Union. He has published an array of books, each with compelling titles which make one want to open them up and immediately start reading. In 2016, he published The Grace of God and the Grace of Man, The Theologies of Bruce Springsteen. In 2015, his book Scripture and Tradition, Rabbi Akiva and the Triumph of Midrash was released. His latest book, Temptation Transformed, The Story of How the Forbidden Fruit Became an Apple, was recently named as one of the 10 best medieval studies books of 2023.
Professor Yadin Israel combines Jewish studies, classical studies, linguistics, philosophy, and biblical studies to develop fascinating theses from the ancient world up to the present day. Fluent in several modern and ancient languages, and a native-level speaker of Hebrew and a scholar of biblical Hebrew, Professor Yadin Israel is uniquely positioned to explain to us the original meaning behind specific words from the Torah. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Because you speak modern Hebrew at a native level, did you have any interest in drawing a connection between modern and ancient Hebrew? Did that interest you in some way, or?
Yeah, definitely. Israelis tend to think of this as just a single continuity, but you know, there are profound differences between modern Israeli Hebrew and both biblical and rabbinic and other strata of Hebrew and what is spoken today. So I think language change in and of itself is fascinating and also critical for anyone who presumes to do any sort of philological work, because if you don't understand the language in its proper historical context, your understanding of the text is going to be deficient. But particularly of interest because of this shift in the history of Hebrew and its kind of renewal as a spoken language. And with that, its application to fields, semantic fields that had been fallow in traditional earlier Hebrew usage, whether it be biblical Hebrew, liturgical, what have you. You know, there are whole areas in modern Hebrew that are new to Hebrew, as it were. And that in and of itself is a very interesting dynamic.
So Hebrew, I guess for someone who's maybe just fascinated by language, maybe we'll say like a language junkie or something like this, a language nerd.
I think nerd is the term that's current today, yeah.
Hebrew is particularly enthralling because it has probably the unique status of once having been an ancient language and now a modern language. And I guess for you, interested in the development of language, you kind of were drawn to this.
Yeah, I don't know if it's unique. I mean, there are attempts, for example, you know, the Irish is a very interesting example where, you know, Gaelic, there are parts of Ireland where Gaelic is emphasized. There are smaller movements, but still significant, for example, to reintroduce Hawaiian as the general language of the Hawaiian Islands. You know, in other words, that to retrieve what had become a largely forgotten language. I don't know exactly how many native speakers of Hawaiian there are, but certainly the numbers are small. And to kind of both reinvigorate it in terms of number of speakers, but also to extend it, to kind of make it suited for the needs of contemporary speakers of language. But, you know, Hebrew is certainly a very interesting and a very special case.
You are listening to The Shrift, interview 18 with Azan Yadin Israel, professor of classics and Jewish studies at Rutgers University. Mishpatim.
We talked about biblical to modern Hebrew. If you could just give the listeners, the Shrift listeners out there, a very quick overview of how it came to be that we have modern Hebrew in the first place, right? Because obviously in the Torah and ancient Judaism, they spoke ancient Hebrew. Maybe you could say a bit about Ben Yehuda and the birth of modern Hebrew.
Sure. The birth of modern Hebrew is part and parcel of the project of Jewish nationalism. So classical European nationalism is understood as the conjunction of territory and language, a language that is a national language. In other words, it's the Volkische Sprache, you know, that the particular language of this people. And Zionism, Jewish nationalism, found itself in an incredibly odd situation of claiming to be a national movement, but having neither territory nor language. Ben Yehuda is a critical figure in this. He is the author of a lexicographer who created the first modern Hebrew dictionary. And when I say created, it's both lexicographical gathering and documentation, but also a great deal of innovation. In other words, there was a terrible need to formulate new words in Hebrew that would serve the needs of, you know, a 19th or 20th century speaker. The Academy of Hebrew Language, it was earlier called Vad HaLashon, and then later became the Academy of Hebrew Language. They had basically scholars from different areas who would meet, and they would discuss what are potential words to replace foreign words that are currently in use. And I mean, this is, you know, they're heated debates, heated debates. There was a huge debate over the Hebrew word for match. Look, there are no matches in the ancient world. So what's the proper Hebrew word? So, you know, they debated, and eventually one word won the day, the Hebrew word gaful. So, but you have, they would produce these dictionaries of agricultural terms, dictionaries of military terms, a dictionary of seafaring. You know, what are the names of the parts of the ship? Not a central semantic field in biblical or Mishnaic Hebrew, but very necessary if you're going to have Hebrew speakers who are sailors, and so on and so forth. So, you know, it was a very kind of ideologically driven project to renew the Hebrew language and make it viable for contemporary speakers.
You have an article, it was called Blorit, Pagans Mohawk or Sabra's Forelock, Ideologically Manipulative Secularization of Hebrew Terms in Socialist Zionist Israel. It's a really fascinating article. And there were a couple of things there that I'd like to ask you about, a couple of points you made. You pointed out how many words that I would describe as holy words in the Torah, yeah, used to describe objects in the temple, prayer maybe, yeah, or sacrifice became, had to be secular and became very mundane. So I just wrote down three examples. Kiyur, which is in modern Hebrew, I believe it means bowl. Or sink.
Kiyur means it's a sink. Yeah, it's the kitchen sink.
Right.
I mean, it can also be a bathroom sink. Yes, but it's the proverbial kitchen sink. Yeah, but of course it is part of the. It's a washbowl used in the tabernacle and later in the temple, which is a great example because ancient Hebrew sources really don't have, largely because of gender issues, largely are missing the terminology of the kitchen. You know, there's just not a lot of like regular kitchen terminology, to say nothing of the fact that there wasn't running water and no one had sinks. So in any case, you would have to innovate this word. So yes, the kior goes back, and the tabernacle wash basin becomes the kitchen sink.
And also kaf, which is, I believe, spoon, and mazleg, yeah, is fork. Those, right, had some different meanings in biblical Hebrew.
Yeah, I mean, mazleg is a biblical term that it is some sort of, it's like an implement that is used by the priest when they're removing sacrificed meat from the altar. So I don't know no one knows exactly what it is or, you know, what it looked like. But for someone who's looking to create a Hebrew word for fork, you could do a lot worse, you know, in terms of how similar that is, or at least it's the closest that you have in the biblical sacrificial implements to what a fork does. That became the word for fork.
So basically, can we picture like Ben Yehuda and his friends saying, okay, we need something for a fork. Let's go with this.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a top down and there's a bottom up method here. The top down is, you know, as you're working on your dictionary, you're seeing other words in other languages that you don't have and realizing those need to be created. And also there's a bottom up, which is that people would write in to this kind of the group of linguists and say, hey, you know, we don't have a word for this. And often the words would be, you know, often they just use like the Russian or international words, like some of which are still used in Hebrew. You know, inflatsia is inflation. But you can see, like in earlier, if you read Hebrew works, you know, from the 20s, let's say from the 1920s, I mean, we're in the 20s. I meant the 20s of the 20th century, the 1920s, then you'll see that there are a lot of those words that have since been replaced by Semitic words, by words that are either Hebrew or at least based on a Hebrew root.
Yeah.
And people would write in and say, hey, we really need a set of terms for this kind of agricultural process or something like that. And they would, that's what they did. They would work. And not all of them take, you know, not all of them.
Right.
You know, I proposed one, but I knew they wouldn't take it. I proposed an innovation for, in Hebrew, email, you say mail or email. My suggestion was that the term be igeret. So igeret is the Hebrew word for letter, or one of the Hebrew words for letter, and it also starts with E.
Yeah.
So you have like E Geret. So, you know, the process continues, not always successfully, as in my case, that hasn't taken yet. One hope springs eternal, so we live in hope. That kind of dynamic, and sometimes they would work, and sometimes they wouldn't. You know, sometimes the words would be integrated into Hebrew, and sometimes they wouldn't.
Hmm. Okay. I guess, with time, theoretically, there's more time to figure it out. I guess if maybe in the beginning you had to, the only option you had was inflatsia, and then someone had a better word down the line and changed it.
Complicated. It's complicated because there are also sociolinguistic aspects to it. In other words, for some Israelis, there's a kind of status involved in using English terminology.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not that everyone is eager to speak, you know, I don't know, undiluted Hebrew or purely Semitic Hebrew or something like that. And all that we're missing are the words, but rather, you know, for many people, it is a marker of a certain kind of identity to integrate English into their Hebrew. So,
sure.
So there are a lot of different factors involved.
Oh yeah.
As they would say, as many Hebrew speakers would say, there are other factors involved. Obviously.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm guilty of trying to work other, particularly French, into my English to have a certain cachet.
Right. Well, there you go. Cachet.
Exactly.
Yeah. A certain je ne sais quoi. Yeah.
Yeah, je ne sais quoi. Find the bon mot.
Right.
Okay. So you also mentioned, which I found interesting, that I think you argued that some words, holy words, were deliberately kind of, I would say, besmirched or maybe denigrated, perhaps, like the word Kabbalah, for example, which is obviously the Jewish mysticism comes from to receive, lekabel, and in modern Hebrew it means reception, right? Like the or right. the lobby reception is the Kabbalah.
It can be, the Kabbalah is the reception of the lobby. A Kabbalah can also be a receipt, like when you purchase something, you get a receipt. Yeah, I don't know if that is an example of it being purposely besmirched.
Okay.
But it certainly is completely secularized and made mundane. It's not only just secularization. In other words, a word, I think I give this example in the article, a word like sacrifice can be secularized in the sense that a sacrifice need not be an offering that is made to the gods or God, but you simply, you know, a sacrifice you make for your country, a sacrifice you make for some cause, for some ideology, that is a secularization, but not, it's not made mundane, but rather you're saying that your cause is as important as framework that to which the word sacrifice previously pertained. In the cases that I'm giving there, it's made mundane. It's made secular and mundane. The funniest example to my mind is the word for the lower, the ontologically lower region. In other words, there are rabbinic distinctions between ha'elyonim, the supernal realm, and ve'atachtonim, the lower realms, the material world. So there's this saying, Ikar Shechina B'tachtonim, the divine presence resides primarily in the lower regions. Okay? That mm-hmm. word, Tachtonim, in modern Hebrew is underwear.
Huh.
So that not only has that term been secularized, you know, not only is it not. Not only is it not being used in a specifically religious context, it's actually been
denigrated,
desecrated in a certain
desecrated. Way, you
know?
Yeah.
So that, you know, if you say to a modern Hebrew speaker, "Ikar Shechina b'tachtonim," A, they're not going to understand what you mean by Shechina, but whatever, you know, they'll think that it's like you're saying that God resides in your underpants. You know what I mean? It's like something completely bizarre. And that's a kind of very sharp semantic shift that you do find in modern Hebrew, where there is a this kind of ideological break with the biblical meaning or the or rabbinic, the earlier meaning.
Well, I know that Ben Yehuda and a lot of the early Zionists were probably atheists and basically socialists and wanted nothing to do
right.
with religion. And
well, that's right. And that actually, I think, is explains a lot of what's going on here, which is that Zionists who are committed to the renewal and reintegration of Hebrew as a national language were faced with a bit of a dilemma, because on the one hand, they believed Hebrew to be the national language. On the other hand, most of the sources that were available to them from Hebrew were religious, assuming that we take the Bible to be a religious text. But let's just make that assumption. That's how most people think of it. So it was either, you know, biblical or rabbinic or liturgical, so that there's a tension here between these two vectors within Zionist thought. On the one hand, the renewal of Hebrew. On the other hand, a desire to distance oneself from the earlier religious Jewish existence. So you have to retrieve Hebrew from religious sources, but rework it in a way that neutralizes the religious aspect of it. So, right. Yeah. So you see what I'm saying? You see the,
of course, yeah.
They're kind of trying to thread this very tricky ideological needle. So part of those, like the temple utensils that we talked about and so forth, are just, you could say, linguistic necessity. You need something to, you need it, you need some word to refer to the kitchen sink or a fork or what have you. But other examples in that article are much more consciously undermining. A word like amal. Amal is the modern Hebrew word for labor. And there are, you know, there's a kibbutz called Tel Amal. And it's a very positive word for socialist Zionism. In biblical Hebrew, it means something like vexation or mischief, religiously speaking. Or it can mean toil, but it's a negative thing. In other words, if you have the verse, Adam le'amal yulad, man was born for amal.
Mm-hmm.
In the original context, that means man is born for naught. You know, you labor, you toil away, and nothing comes of it. In socialist Zionist Hebrew, Adam le'amal yulad means we were born for labor. We were born to work in a positive sense, you know, in a socialist sense of productivity and so forth. So that word kind of underwent this complete shift in terms of its valence.
Yeah. So basically this very the socialist kind of pro-work, pro-worker mentality was imprinted on the new language, and also in a way that rejected this negative view of labor from the ancient world. Like this is a new...
Yeah, or at least with that word. I don't know if there's always a negative... view of labor in the ancient world, but certainly that word was a very negative one. Yes, the modern ideology of productivity, labor, etc., is kind of superimposed onto that word, and it is re-semanticized.
Okay, so I'm just curious, like, as because you are a native level Hebrew speaker. When you read the Torah, would you compare it to reading like an English speaker reads like Shakespearean English? I mean, how do you feel when you read the Torah as like a, do you feel like you're reading another language or like a foreign language?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think it's a foreign language, but it's somewhere between Shakespeare and Chaucer, I'd say.
Okay.
You know, it's that tricky transition from Middle English to Early Modern English. So, first of all, it depends what part of the Torah. If you're reading the Book of Job, then it's like, you know, it's closer to reading Anglo-Saxon. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but it's, you know, parts of the Torah are very, very, of the Tanakh, of the Bible, broadly are very difficult. Job is infamously difficult in terms of its Hebrew. But generally, I think it's parts of it are like Shakespeare, parts of it are like Chaucer. Yeah.
I noticed that If you have a Hebrew English dictionary, like the Hebrew section will be way smaller than the English section, right? Like the English words will be at least four times as many. And I mean, I thought of an example, like Hebrew, the word, in general, there's just way fewer words in Hebrew than in English. So like the word for closet, or you have the word aron in Hebrew, which means closet and other things. In English, we have cabinet, we have closet, we have cupboard. I think we have you have maybe armoire, or well, at least that's three or four. Why is that? Why does English have so many?
English has its own really interesting history. But over centuries of exposure to Romance languages, obviously, most prominently after 1066, after the Norman conquest, but even prior to that, of course, there is a kind of bifurcation within English, where you have more basic words that are Germanic, but with that, a very, very rich, learned vocabulary drawn largely from Romance, which is to say ultimately Latin and Latin descendants. And Hebrew has not had that growth. Hebrew has not had that encounter with the way English did with French, with over the hundreds and hundreds of years, and it hasn't had that scientific growth over hundreds and hundreds of years. So I think a lot of the disparity is due to that.
Right. And I guess also back then in ancient times, there just wasn't as many, as much stuff, or there wasn't as much development and in
Right,
culture.
right,
And
right,
yeah,
right. If you, you know,
if you even had one closet, you were lucky, you know.
Right. This is it. We don't want to become a Monty Python skit. You're like, oh, you had a closet. We dreamt of a closet.
I noticed after reading the Parsha for of Mishpatim, which is the subject of this interview, and just throughout the Torah, that when the status of the Hebrews when they were slaves in Egypt, they're referred to as Evedim, as
Abedin, yeah.
yeah. And I also noticed that this word Eved, from modern Hebrew, it has the same root for work, Oved. I will come more to this later about this word Eved, but I guess my opening question would be, if you said in Hebrew Ani Eved versus Ani Oved, would that be like Ani Eved would be I'm a slave and Ani Oved would be I'm a worker? Is that how you would translate it?
I mean, Ani Eved would be I'm a slave, yes. Ani Oved, it depends. It's a participle, and participles, by their nature, can be either nominal or verbal. So you can say Ani Oved could be I'm a worker, or Ani Oved could be I am working.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Because obviously in English, worker and slave have no etymological
That's
connection,
right.
whereas in Hebrew, there's a connection etymologically. Was there a word for worker in biblical Hebrew, or was it always just eved, like for just a normal
Well,
worker?
see, well, so first of all, Eved, Eved, it doesn't even just mean slave in biblical Hebrew. First of all, there's no distinction in Hebrew between what we would distinguish as slave versus servant. So Eved means both slave and servant. And obviously those words have a very different connotation. In English, in Hebrew, they're the same word. So that is just, you know, the first challenge, as it were, which is, when are you saying slave and when are you saying servant? And Evid also has a completely different set of connotations, which come from the world of worship. So Evid is also one who worships. So you could be like the Evid of God, meaning, you know, the one who worships God. And that would also be true of Oved, of to work, to labor, is also to worship. So like Ovadia, the name Ovadia, the name of a biblical prophet, or Obadiah in English. But I mean, Ovadia is one who worships the Lord. Right. It's the same thing is true in Arabic. Abdullah. Abdullah is one who worships God, one who worships Allah. You know, Ovadia and Abdullah are basically the same name, one in Hebrew and one in Arabic. So Eved does mean slave. It does mean servant, and it can also mean worshiper. And, you know, a lot will depend on the context, of course.
Right. So in English, of course, there's a huge difference between being a servant and a slave, right?
Right.
Like, not just in the connotation, but also just in facts, right?
Yeah, yeah. Although I'd say also, you know, the there's a similar complexity, you know, if you take German, within Germanic, right? The word Knecht in German, which is kind of servant slash slave. The English cognate of Knecht is a knight. So the knight is the Knecht of the king. So the knights of the round table are
servants.
Are servants of the king. Yeah.
Right.
Obviously, completely different connotation, you know, I mean, and also different denotation. If you say Knecht in German, it means one thing. If you say knight in English, it means something completely different. But in fact, they're from the same root.
Interesting.
But they just, you know, split off in somewhat different way, where knight is the servant specifically of the king within the context of chivalry, you know, within this model of the medieval chivalry.
Right. So essentially, language is always, or words are always sort of changing based on, or always have different flavors of meaning based on context and usage.
Well, that, yes, that's certainly true. And also, and just historically, I mean, look, the example I gave you now, I mean, that happens all the time between English and German. Where there's semantic narrowing, usually English, there's semantic narrowing. So, you know, a word like sterben in German, which is the general term for dying, in English, the cognate is a very specific type of dying, to starve.
Oh, I never saw that connection. Okay.
Or the German word Tier, which is just the generic term for animal, is a cognate of the English word deer, which is like the forest animal, the deer. Why? There's no answer to the question. Why? Because this kind of change is a linguistic constant. There is no underlying assumption that words should remain with the same form and the same meaning. They simply change over time. And in cognate languages, there will be interesting shifts like that, you know, in this case, between German and English.
I'm thinking now about like animals, because you mentioned animal tier. And actually, sometimes there are a lot of animals which can be used, like the same animal can be something positive or negative, like fox. Like you might say, oh, she's a fox, talking about like a attractive, or maybe even for he's a fox, like attractive person. think that's more
You
she.
could say that if it were 1977, yes, you could.
Yeah. Well, okay. I'm thinking on my feet here. But
Yeah.
a fox could also be negative, like someone who's kind of crafty or like I guess, well, snake, I think, is always pretty much always negative. Dog can sometimes be, that's usually pretty negative too, I guess. But I guess my point is,
Not an African American vernacular,
oh, right, that's true. Right. So I guess my point is with slave or with servant and connect, right? Like the knights of the round table, that's a good connect. And then if you're just some lowly servant, that's a bad connect, right? Slave, I think, is obviously very, in English, a very negative, almost, it's a very negative word, of course. But even sometimes that, I think, can. I'm just thinking now of the Britney Spears song "Slave." I don't know if you know it. It's like a hit, maybe, and it's sort of
God, does it?
a
Sorry.
sexualized song, like "I'm a slave for you," and there it's sort of taking on like a, at least a sort of, a, yeah. I mean, it's a Britney Spears song, so it's sort of upbeat.
No, well, of course, slave does come to mean someone who is enslaved to their needs. If you're an addict, then you're a slave to whatever, alcohol or whatever it might be, or and also if you're talking about it in a romantic or sexual framework, then there's the idea of like complete submission.
Right.
So which depending, not judging, whatever people are into, that could have a popular or a positive sense. But yeah, it definitely the core meaning of slave in English is negative and much more negative than Evid,
Yeah, and
or
that
much
was
more.
my main question is, well, is that, I mean, is that true? That's sort of the, what is it, the
Well, it's
$50,000
context
question?
dependent. $64,000 question. Yeah,
$64,000. Yeah.
it's context dependent because, certainly when on Passover, the Passover Seder people recite Avadim hayinu leparo v'mitzrayim. We were Avadim, but God brought us out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Clearly, that is a transition from serfdom, slavery, to liberty. And the slavery in Egypt is kind of the prototypical historic setting of bad slavery, of being enslaved, having no rights, having to do whatever the tyrant tells you to do, and so forth. There are Hebrew slaves in the Bible, Eved Ivri, which is, people who will send themselves into indentured servitude. That's a, you know, there's another term, indentured servitude, that which is also folded into the word Eved in Hebrew.
Right, but the context can shed light on how bad of a slavery situation it was.
Yes, exactly.
Blank.
In the very final verses of the Torah, Moses himself is referred to as an Eved. I discovered this while reading the Torah with my fiancée, Annie. Annie grew up in Berlin and is a native German speaker. In fact, we were reading the Torah in a German translation, and we stumbled upon the German word, Knecht. Moses was described as the Knecht of Hashem. Annie recoiled upon witnessing Moshe so described. "It's not nice to call someone a Knecht," she said. "In German, that's like calling someone a slave, or like some lowly worker. When I was in high school, kids would get made fun of and would be called that." I tried to think of how Knecht in this context would be translated into English. "Would it be like calling someone a loser?" I asked her. "Yeah," she said. "That's why I couldn't believe the Torah would refer to Moshe that way." I quickly opened up a Hebrew-English Torah to see what the original word for Knecht was. And sure enough, there it was, staring back at me, Eved. The Torah employed the same word to describe Moshe's relationship to God as the relationship of the Hebrew slaves to Pharaoh.
And there are other places where Eved can be even positive term in a certain way. There's a famous passage in the Talmud, in the Tractate Brachot. The Tractate Brachot deals with benedictions and prayers and so forth. And in the Tractate, there's a series of stories. There are two that are relevant to this conversation. One is kind of the preparatory story where Rabban Gamliel's son, Rabban Gamliel is a very prominent kind of institutional rabbinic figure. His son is sick, and he sends two students to Hanina ben Dosa. That's his name, Hanina ben Dosa, who pray for him. These students go to Hanina ben Dosa and say, "Pray for the son of Rabban Gamliel." And he prays, and he comes back, and he tells them his fever is broken. And they say, "How do you know? Are you a prophet?" And he says, "No, but I know that if my prayer flows, that it's been accepted. If my prayer flows, my request has been accepted." They write down the time when he said this, go back to Rabban Gamliel, and he says, "Indeed, you are correct. That's the very moment when my son's fever broke and he asked for a cup of water." Great. Second story, basic, very, very similar, with a different rabbinic figure, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, kind of the father of rabbinic Judaism, the most institutional figure in that sense. Again, his son is sick. He asks Hanina ben Dosa to pray for him. He does, and the son is healed. After this happens, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's wife says to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, "Is Hanina greater than you are? Because after all, he was able to pray and, you know, you were helpless when it came to your own son, whereas Hanina was able to pray and heal him." And he says to her, "No, rather, hu dome ke'eved lifnei ha-melech. He is like an eved in the presence of the king, and I am like a minister in the presence of the king." Now, if you understand Eved to mean slave, the sentence makes no sense. What does that even mean? A slave is going to be greater than a minister? That makes no sense. In fact, the Eved of the king is something like the king's valet. He cares for the king. He's his personal attendant. He cares for the king. He bathes the king. He dresses the king. He is with the king during meals, etc., etc., which means that he has a relationship with the king that allows him to make requests. You know, he's right there with the king at all time. So the Eved has an intimacy with the king that the minister doesn't. The minister can't barge into the king's private quarters and just say, you know, "I want this to happen." The minister has to be summoned. He can't just show up. So here, the word Eved, and this isn't followed by any explanation. In other words, there's no there's no like paragraph after this saying, hey, you know, the reason this makes sense is that the Evid is actually the king's personal attendant and this is what it means and so on. So none of that happens. It's simply understood that the word Evid refers to the personal valet or the personal attendant. So here the Evid is actually, you know, enjoys greater intimacy than does the minister.
So that's another meaning of the word Evid is like personal valet.
Yeah.
Personal.
Yeah. Well, you know, in some sense you'd say servant, and that would be a very particular kind of servant, the personal valet or attendant. And it is highlighting the positive nature of being the Evid.
Right.
Which is this increased intimacy with the king.
I mean, I do think there is sort of, and the king, just so our listeners know, refers to God in this case, right? Like the
that's right.
It's
yeah,
an
yeah,
actual
yeah,
king.
Yeah.
But in
no,
it could
not an actual king.
But it could be Evid could refer to in another story or another situation where the king has his valet and it's his Evid.
Well, the parable works because you're supposed to understand that human kings have a valet.
Right.
And human
right.
kings have ministers.
Right.
That are only allowed to approach the king when summoned. And then you, based on that reality and that is an Evid, you understand that the parable is like, he to God is like an Evid to the king, whereas I am like a minister to the king. Yeah.
I mean, I think we can sort of see the logic of the use of the word Evid here. A slave is sort of can be seen as intimate with the master, obviously in a very negative and inhumane way, in the sense that he has total control over the Evid when
yeah.
it's a slave. So
right.
in the sense that total control has something to do with intimacy, I think that's probably why that word can be used in both contexts, Evid.
Right. Right. Yeah.
When we hear about the Hebrews having been Evidim, if a quote unquote slave back then was a more flexible concept than today, because I mean in history of course we've had slaves that have been totally controlled, dominated, no freedom, and whether this word Evid, because it has a much more flexible usage, if we could infer, okay, the Hebrew slaves, maybe they weren't really slaves the way we think of slaves today, or if the context refutes that idea.
Well, I mean, I think that the point, as I understand, is that the Hebrew word Evid has a much broader semantic range than slave. So as always, when you're dealing with a word that has various meanings and various shades of meanings, then you have to look at the context. And if it says, you know, the Israelites were slaves and they were worked from dawn to dusk building these cities for Pharaoh, and that Pharaoh told them, you know, you have to double the production of the bricks and so on and so forth, that context does seem like something like what we would use to speak about slaves. It wouldn't carry the racialized overtones that a slave can have in modern times, but it would be like slaves in the ancient world, you know, people who were subjugated to another people in that particular way. In other places, the context will be different. Obviously, Evid in the Talmud, in Brachot, in Tractate Brachot, it would be ridiculous to understand in those terms, because if Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying to his wife, oh, he's able to, he, in other words, Hanina ben Dosa, is able to pray for our son's well-being because he's an Evid, then that would be a complete non sequitur. In fact, in that context, we have to understand Evid in a different way, in the way that we mentioned, as the valet, the intimacy with the king, i.e. with God, and so on and so forth.
So theoretically, if the word slave existed back then in the ancient Hebrew world, they might have used that word for the Hebrew slaves.
Yeah. I mean, I think Evid does mean slave.
Yeah.
Along with other things, you know.
Right.
You know, it does mean that among others. And that's what's tricky, is that we, because we have various words, slave seems to have become like the dominant translation of Evid in ways that are not necessarily justified. It's completely justified in certain contexts, but unjustified in others.
And the Hebrew, the slaves, in the Hebrew slaves in Egypt, it is justified.
Yes. That seems to be, it seems to be that the book of Exodus is portraying the Hebrews as being enslaved in the way that we understand the term. I mean, the fact is that Pharaoh, according to this narrative, decides to murder all the firstborn sons and just, you know, issues a command. That is a kind of chattel slavery model of just, you know, doing what you will with the slaves, and then they have no say, no recourse, no anything. Other places the word Evid is used, and it clearly does not mean slave, and it is incumbent upon us, to the extent that we want to understand these ancient texts as fully and as properly as we can, it is incumbent upon us to distinguish whether Evid means slave, or whether it means servant, or whether it means valet, or whether it means worshiper, you know, and what the proper kind of semantic matches there.
Okay. I mean, I guess, again, maybe we could compare it to the example of dog I brought up before, where in some cases a dog can be positive and in some cases very negative. If you're calling a human a dog, right? Like men are dogs is obviously negative when it's used that way.
Right. Right. Presumably that's being spoken by a woman.
Yes.
Presumably it's being spoken by a woman who is dating, comes back from a date and is like, oh, men are dogs. Something like that. You know, that's the kind of classic cultural framing of that kind of statement.
Could be he's my dog. Could be like, he's my friend. He's my buddy.
Right.
And we'd have to look at the context in that situation, maybe. Actually did a little research that even in the Roman world, where of course they had slaves, but they didn't call them slaves. They were called servants, some ancient root of servant, from which we also get the word serf. And obviously this word too probably had to be taken based on context.
Yeah.
And then in the word slave actually comes from Slav, when in the 9th century, Slavic people were taken as prisoners, captors, and workers. And this deserves its own episode to discuss, but somehow the specific meaning of Slav, slave, I guess, took precedence over servant or serf to describe a specific type of bondage.
To some extent, the richness of sources allowed for English to have the kind of differentiation we have between servant, serf, slave, and so forth, Whereas in Hebrew, these are all kind of tied in with Eved. All these different right. meanings are tied with Eved. And therefore, you need to look at the context in which the word is used and not just assume that it means slave in any kind of, you know, mechanical way. You can't just mechanically translate Eved as slave. You have to see if that is, in fact, appropriate. In some cases, it will be, but in many other cases, it won't.
Thank you so much. That was Azan Yadin Israel. It was so great talking to you. I learned so much.
Looking forward All to right. it. Thank you.
Sure.
In the end, my theory that a Hebrew slave was more of a worker than a slave was quickly and easily disproved by Azan. It is true that slave in Hebrew, Eved, has the same root letters as work, Avodah, but the story, or so it seems, ends here. As Azan astutely pointed out, where we have fewer words at our disposal, we must turn to context and usage to make the best with what we have. In English, for example, we have the fruit orange, and we also have a smaller variant of this fruit known as a clementine. It's nice to be able to say clementine, but if, God forbid, we had never been gifted this word, we could just say small orange or baby orange, and everyone would know what we meant. If I said I reached into the fruit basket and grabbed out five oranges, everyone would know they were actually clementines, as a human hand can't hold so many oranges at once. Similarly, ancient Hebrew never had a special word for slave, but those folks being whipped to build the pyramids under the hot Egyptian sun were surely not just workers, even if we technically sort of called them that. Still, I'm not sure my theory was totally debunked. It is worth asking why a separate word for slave never developed in ancient Hebrew. Slavery was, horrifically and tragically, often accepted as normal in the ancient world. It might be that the distinction between a paid worker was, to an ancient mind, not worth distinguishing from a worker forced to labor under pain of death. In any case, the etymology, origin, and history of words, or lack thereof, tell a story about the culture in which these words were used. But making sweeping conclusions about the culture, as I did when I analyzed Parsha Mishpatim on episode 18 of the Shrift, is not unlike making a TikTok video summing up the Middle East conflict. In fact, we are all more guilty of this TikToking of words than we might realize. Years ago, for example, I was at a cocktail type of party and I got into a conversation with someone about history. We were talking about history, and the man interrupted me and said, "Do you know where the word history comes from? His story. His story. It's just somebody else's story. It's not the truth." Actually, though, the word history comes from the Greek word historia, and it has no connection whatsoever with the English possessive pronoun his. Maybe that example is a straw man. Most of the time, it is extremely enlightening to contemplate the etymology of words, particularly when comparing them across languages, even if one does not have the expertise of a philologist like Azan. Still, though, words are things which we can hardly ever overthink. Indeed, the greatest overthinker of them all, Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, once remarked, "Words, words, words." This line is generally thought to reflect Hamlet's frustration with the limits of language, seeing words as ultimately powerless, just empty, enticing vessels. Still, though, when we remember that this verse originates with the Bard, the inventor of 1,700 words in the English language, words, words, words begins to drip with irony.